When your mood is clear, you quickly change your ways. Then you say I'm untrue. What am I supposed to do? Be a fool who sits alone waiting for you.
WBAI, New York. I don't know, interrupting Stevie. I'm going to have to deal with Steve Marshall about that a little bit later on. Good afternoon, everyone. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio, WBAI, in New York at 99.5 FM. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide throughout the afternoon into the early part of the evening. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, trying to help you and us all lead a more positively minded life. We're on the web at WBAI.org, thanks to Porous, P-O-R-U-S, Porous.com. Right now, it's time for Natural Living with Gary Null.
Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, continuing with the ongoing in-depth investigative reporting series, AIDS, A Second Opinion, Part 12. On the previous program, I went into some depth about there are two schools of thought within the AIDS dissident community. One school, headed by Dr. Peter Duesberg, suggests that AIDS is caused by lifestyle, intravenous drug use primarily, and defects within the immune system of those people who have been using drugs. And then AZT, which will decimate the person's immune system. Instead of rebuilding a drug addict's system, we'll frequently go into hurting the person, what is known as iatrogenic episodes. On the other side is a large number of scientists, and growing, that says we question whether or not HIV has actually been fully isolated and cultured. They also believe that oxidative stress, due to a whole myriad of conditions, including psychological stress, has caused what they're calling AIDS. AIDS is 30 different separate conditions, and many of them not even immune-related, that have been called AIDS, and all of them are said to come from this one single virus. After my last program, I received some emails of some scientists, public health officials, who said, for us to believe that the legitimacy of your challenge should be taken seriously, we would like more understanding of the differences in the prove it or prove it not group. In other words, Duesberg, who says there's proof that HIV exists, but it's not strong enough to cause these illnesses. It's just like all other retroviruses, they can't cause it. But he does believe this exists. And Dr. Eleni Papadopoulos, and Dr. Stefan Lanka, and a whole other series of scientists who say we've studied all the original material, something the average physician or scientist has not done, and we challenge it's ever actually been existent. So I am going to talk about philosophically, as well as practically, the implications of this on this one program. Coming up in this series, I'll also go through natural alternative treatments that have not been advocated, and the politics and history of AZT and the other drugs, including fraud in the initial testing of AZT. I noted that Dr. Duesberg shared with Orthodoxy the view that HIV does exist, though he has become an apostate in many other areas. One might ask, why has he stubbornly clung to this particular element of acceptable belief, although he solidly aligned himself with the dissenters on so many other issues? Could it possibly have to do with his position within the scientific world? Disputants on both sides, the virus does not exist, include many scientists. However, Duesberg, along with Dr. Gallo and Dr. Montagnier, and other leading adherents of HIV dogma, and as distinguished from Dr. Papadopoulos and her entire group, he isn't a retrovirus. They are not. He was a pioneer in the field and achieved recognition and prominence within it. It could be teased out, then, that as much as he owes his success and reputation to what has happened in that area, he is likely to remain loyal to it. Let's imagine a scenario, to conduct a little thought experiment on our own, in which new findings strongly suggest AIDS was caused by bacteria. Now imagine further that two camps form, one adamantly assailing and the other supporting the new theory. On one side, let us project, was made up of bacteriologists, and the other, retrovirologists. Can anyone doubt who would be on each side? In our world, one's prestige, even ability to function as a scientist, depends upon funding. There are few gentlemen scholars anymore who, like Baron von Frankenstein, could afford to equip their own laboratories. When a cure for a disease is being sought, government or corporate funding will flow into the pockets of students who work in the area of medicine that appears to promise relief. And so, if bacteriologists, say, manage to begin convincing people that AIDS was due to a new strain of bacteria, the funding floodgates would open into their domain while being closed to retrovirologists. This is not meant cynically. It stands to reason that a person will grant more importance to what he or she is familiar with. Scientists will magnify the significance of events and entities in their own field while diminishing the value of developments in neighbors' areas of expertise. The retrovirus, which a bacteriologist will probably consider from afar a rather simple and dull creature, after all, is not really alive like a bacterium, will be viewed by retrovirologists from close up as capable of amazing feats of longevity, violence, and penetration. On today's program, we're going to look at the different formations that come from total immersion in one specialized discipline, ending, however, for once, on a more positive note, in that I will call up, in contrast, two representative instances of how the AIDS situation has been the proving ground for pioneering moves to free medicine from its elitist and overspecialized shackles. To our first topic, when Duesberg, Gallo, and others first made names for themselves, it was in the early 70s, retrovirology was a hot area, a trendy and exciting field in which, for the first time, with reverse transcriptase, RNA took on a role no one had believed it could perform. Yet as the decade wore on, retrovirology lost some of its sheen when it was discovered that reverse transcriptase was not as eccentric and or dangerous as it first appeared. It lost even more luster when further breakthroughs were not as dazzling as anticipated. Now, some writers have argued that both these experiences affected the mindset of retrovirologists who shifted into AIDS research in the early 80s. That is, they were influenced by the then-current eclipse of their own field and by memories of glory days long gone by. Dr. Stefan Lanka believes that once retrovirology declined in interest, it then affected the rest of the scientific world, especially when all those identified at the time were benign. Those who studied them sometimes went off the deep end. Until AIDS was invented and retrovirologists were a minority sect who were happy to accept each other's flights of fancy without being too critical. They could fiddle around in their hearts with safe, what they considered pliable science. And their knowledge that retroviruses were the least dangerous of all viruses. That was written. The retroviruses were the least dangerous of all. In fact, when I interviewed Dr. Peter Duesberg, when I went out to his campus office at University of California, Berkeley, he stopped the interview at one point and he turned around and he had a whole giant shelf and he pulled one humongous book off and he held it up and he said, "Gary, look at this." He said, "In here are thousands of abstracts, thousands and thousands of abstracts of studies on retroviruses." He says, "We know everything there is to know about retroviruses. And not one retrovirus of all these hundreds of thousands of studies does anything like this HIV virus is supposed to do, which is called a retrovirus." He said, "How is it that this one HIV virus could do something that these hundreds of thousands of studies and other retroviruses couldn't do?" He says, "It's just not plausible." And then put the book back on the shelf and we continued on with the interview. Well, well-meaning and credulous colleagues, as well as aspiring virologists and journalists, and through them, laymen were mesmerized by incomprehensible jargon. And fiddling around is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it is the first step towards an imaginative leap that can lead to a discovery. But there was one definite bad practice in the retroviralogy camp that a number of dissenters have noted. This was the refusal to give up an early contention which had brought fame and fanfare to the retrovirus, but which later proved to be less than scientifically accurate, such as the belief that reverse transcriptase was, like a budding Hollywood starlet, under an exclusive contract to the retrovirus, and that these retroviruses that had stood in on its head previous biological dogma must be diabolical. Writing in Continuum, Dr. Crayfield argues that the earliest supposition about reverse transcriptase activity was that it was confined to the poisted action of assumed to exist retroviruses. That's assumed to exist retroviruses. The excitement created by the existence of reverse transcriptase action made retrovirology a cutting-edge discipline. But the idea that retroviruses were the unique sites of reverse transcriptase activity was soon challenged. Quote, "It later became accepted that reverse transcription is not an exceptional marvel at all, but a normal process in cells. No retrovirus needed to explain it." Unquote. It was seen, for example, that reverse transcription activity took place in such mundane locales as the chromosomes of yeast, where, quote, "it was shown that reverse transcription reflects a repair mechanism of damage to the cellular genetic material." Unquote. Yet, was it likely that the study of retroviruses, once they were seen to be not as special as they first appeared, would be sidelined? Crayfield notes that by the time of the deflation of the virus, quote, "great retrovirologists had arisen, known worldwide, like Robert Gallo, Luke Montagnier, and Duesberg." Unquote. With so much prestige, so much funding arising from top scientists working in the field, it's unlikely the study of retroviruses would be abandoned, let alone would their existence be doubted. Few, then, question whether these marvelous viruses actually existed. For here's another catch. Because reverse transcriptase activity at first seemed so out of the ordinary, it seemed natural to assume it had to be carried out by a novel being, such as the retrovirus. But while the operation of reverse transcriptase enzyme itself was well documented, the existence of retroviruses was not. Quote, "retroviruses as a source of reverse transcription had still not been proven to exist as a biological entity, thus to exist at all." Unquote. All the problems that we saw plaguing the isolation of HIV were first met here right at the beginning. For it was not, as the listener might have assumed, that sudden, unexpected difficulties arose around the isolation and identification of HIV, which was a particularly pesky retrovirus. These same difficulties had been beset attempts at isolation of all human retroviruses. Dr. Stephen Lanka, one of the world's leading virologists, professor of virology in Germany, put it like this. He says, no retrovirus was ever shown to exist, for example, by being able to isolate and characterize it and to demonstrate its transmissibility. These failures, obviously not for want of trying, should have been sufficed to kill off the whole concept. It may be hard to believe that all maps purporting to represent a whole retrovirus, including HIV, are always compilations. Unquote. I quoted the very last sentence before, but then the emphasis was then on HIV, so the listener wouldn't have known Lanka meant to say the difficulties in isolating particles has been endemic in retrovirological research. Even before HIV, some retrovirologists had considered dropping Koch's postulates and substituting new and to many unacceptable methods of identifying viral particles. Lanka explains. He says, the rules demonstrating the existence of HIV and retroviruses in general, which is to say commonly accepted procedures for specimen isolation and use of that isolated specimen to infect cultures, were never adhered to, nor were they ever validated. Unquote. As we saw, retrovirologists would bandy about terms such as isolation and the most rigorous method, but they would no longer meant what they had meant before. Terms were used in retrovirology, according to Lanka, rather as they were used in Alice in Wonderland. It means what I want it to mean. So journalists didn't know this. So if a journalist asks a scientist, now you've isolated. Oh, yes, we've isolated. That was the end of it. No one said, show me the exact method. Show me the entire virus. One single complete virus. Ah, there's the rub. Because nobody could show one single complete HIV banded virus. It was all compilation. Dr. Lanka has personalized this whole tragic situation by writing about Peter Duisberg, who, we saw, straddles orthodoxy and dissidence. Lanka acknowledges that, quote, Duisberg's enormous services to mankind are beyond dispute. For nearly 10 years, he has steadfastly and at great personal cost been the anchor of sanity and decency in a world driven mad by the simple-minded HIV theory, unquote. Yet his notable courage has understandably not extended so far as to allow him to rethink some of the basic dogmas of the field he has helped found. How can he do so? This would be like Sigmund Freud, for example, late in life, after his reputation had been made, suddenly saying he was wrong and that there was no such thing as subconscious. Let's look in more detail at Lanka's argument, since it will loop back to points that I raised earlier about the manner in which this new technology may bias thought. Retroviruses were postulated as being that species of microorganism which caused reverse transcriptase to occur, which as a working hypothesis at the time in the early 1970s was entirely reasonable. The mistake was made to elevate the hypothesis to dogma. Early gene detection techniques lent some credence to the existence of an entity that could be transmitted from one cell to another, which was unfortunate because this too turned out to be wrong. Errors of this kind occur whenever technology makes available for general use a new experimental procedure, which propels a whole army of researchers into mass producing experimental data, heedless of what the biological significance, if any, of that work might be. Now, this is more substantiation to our claim that technology often drives research. Here is the capacity of new apparatus to provide electromicrographs of ultra-minute goings-on within cells, as well as allow them to analyze and make up these entities that encourage scientists to begin studying fragments and strands of protein and DNA found in cells. But while the technology could depict and analyze these fragments, it could not tell scientists what they were or what they meant. Here, in interpreting the data, Lanka argues it was the prejudices of the retrovirologists that had a field day to the point of when one interpretation proved invalid, immediately supplying another that was even more jerry-built without ever questioning the soundness of the foundation would occur. He says, Even worse is the retroviologist's habit of making countless ad hoc adjustments to the original theory, which completely distort the original hypothesis. Correct science demands that there should be a radical rethink when this happens. If there isn't, as in the case, and in this case of AIDS, a fundamental flaw in the concept goes haywire, ending in disaster. This lack of intellectual rigor has, in a contemporary metaphor, debased molecular biology to a virtual science, leading to the deplorable state of having a disease, AIDS, with a virtual definition due to a virtual pathogen, HIV. Now, the personal cost to Duisberg was that he would be forced to fight a battle with holds barred, which is to say he would have to halt his research in question within narrow lines, and that he was trying to preserve the basic edifice of retrobiology while renovating some of its floors. Duisberg went along with mainstream AIDS researchers, limiting his objections to the relatively minor aspect of whether HIV would cause AIDS or not, whereas he really ought to have smelled a rat regarding the whole concept of retroviruses, given his earlier courageous stance in admitting the mistaken role of retroviruses in causing cancer, long before anyone else did. And as we know, retroviruses did not cause cancer. But you wouldn't have known that for 20 years when a virologist was one of the heads of the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society was loaded with retroviruses. That's where the money went. Every year, new promises of a retrovirus as the cause of cancer never materialized. But we never look back at what didn't happen after people promised us it would happen. And after enormous amounts of money and time and hope were spent and nothing gained, and we just keep allowing the same people now to jump from cancer into AIDS. Same people, by the way. All the people heading the war on AIDS were in the war on cancer. Which brings up a further topic, the role of retroviruses in causing any of these major diseases. Once the pristine uniqueness of retroviruses was tarnished by further research, such as that showing the benignness of reverse transcriptase behavior in normal cell repair, it would seem retroviologists would need to find new lands to conquer or risk being spurned by fellow researchers and, more importantly, funders. This is when Robert Gallo leapt into the breach as he began to study retroviruses as a cancer cause. As Dr. Eliopoulos and her entire group of scientists challenge, she says, he was one of the many virologists caught up in President Nixon's decade of war against cancer. As we mentioned, he was spurred by his sister's tragic death from leukemia, and thus professional and deeply personal motives intertwined, to study this disease in the mid-1970s, said he had, quote, isolated HL23V, which was said to be the retrovirus absolutely responsible for human leukemia, heralded as news, headlines, hero. His proof, as my quotes around isolation will have alerted careful listeners, indicate that this did not involve accepted procedures of isolation, but those less exacting ones being cooked up by the retroviologists. As Dr. Eliopoulos' version of what happened next is, quote, not long afterwards, others, retroviologists, claimed to have found the same antibodies in many people who did not have leukemia. However, a few years later, these same antibodies were shown to occur naturally and be directed against many substances that had nothing to do with retroviologists, has nothing to do with leukemia. Then it was realized that HL23V was one big mistake. There was no HL23V retrovirus. It did not exist. So Gallo, the king, the emperor, had data that turned out to be embarrassing because HTL23V did not exist. However, this fiasco was of some value, at least to retroviologists, in that it helped them perfect ways of, quote, isolating, unquote, viruses and working with antibodies to identify particles. Though these methods were not strictly kosher scientifically, they did provide an alternative, a seemingly rational approach to working with viral materials when older methods failed to obtain any results. And this is no small matter, for to be convincing one has to have means of establishing credibility, if not with precisely consensually agreed upon methods, then with newly created ones that seem to serve the same purpose. Strategically, the ability to tie these new methods to new technologies is a strong plus in that it imitates initiates that these means of proof are replacing the old, not as a measure of desperation because the old tests aren't working, but as an advance allowed by breakthroughs in the creation of assessing apparatuses. As we've seen then, that in the dissenter's opinion, the AIDS crisis has provided something of a salvation to the reputations and the funding of retrovirologists who were at a dead end. All their earlier discoveries, dead-ended. Retroviruses are the cause of cancer, major other diseases, dead-ended. All their hero status, crumbled. Isn't amazing how they remade themselves? And this so-called HIV was their salvation. The identification of HIV was a godsend for retroviologists, in that it put them back into the center of the medical science. The dissenters argue further that regardless of the reality of HIV, the retroviruses, quote, years in the wilderness gave them time to cultivate some bad habits, such as a disregard for older, proper scientific standards, which they had trouble meeting. It is this that predisposed them to such actions as throwing out cautious principles as so much useless baggage. However, though, understandable within their terms of argument, the dissenter may give a false impression when they gang up on a retrovirologist. They may suggest that this discipline is particularly egregious in its sins of disciplinary inbreeding. I would like to argue, and will say more about this at the end of this particular program, that medicine as it is practiced under the older paradigm is endemically crabbed, that is, weakened by narrowness and elitism. The latter parts of my discussion will deal with the emergence of a new paradigm in alternative medicine, which, let me emphasize, will not only be innovative theoretically, for example, in how it looks at disease, but in practice, particularly in how it emphasizes empowerment of patients and cooperation rather than paternalism and the coerced or frightened passivity of patients. Here, let me preview a few thoughts on cooperation, since in the alternative paradigm, mutuality provides a valuable antidote to the rampant specialization. Let me begin by saying that I don't damn the retrovirologists' urge to magnify their domain, distorting reality to do so, for this tendency is part of human nature. An idol of the theater in Bacon's usage, however, as the Elizabethan counseled, it has to be resisted and can be resisted for the good of science. However, when Bacon fashioned his warnings against such idols, he had in mind subjective resistance. That is, he held that an astute individual could resist the blandishments of these idols by a strong-minded self-control. Here I break with this master. Just as I have suggested, it is easy to flow with a pack, so I would argue, against accepted positions, it is most productive to forge a new trail with the pack. I am saying one begins by becoming a rebel en masse. Let me try to remove the paradoxical sting from this assertion. First, by a word about my own efforts, then with some thoughts about AIDS and community, offering a different version of science, that one conducive to discipline, sopalism. I've said in my discussions that virtually all my work is in part a byproduct of group consciousness, both in that it is researched and written and broadcast as a flowering interaction between both what you see and the results that you get with someone. Let's say I'm working with someone with AIDS, and they change their diet, and suddenly their thrush clears up, or they get an intravenous vitamin C drip or an ozone infusion, and a serious infection around their heart, endocarditis, clears up. Or they have chronic fever, and the fever clears up. And so what you see from this, you begin to distill a certain amount of wisdom that you're gaining from the feedback that the person is giving you, both in what they're stating and what you're seeing in their blood chemistry and their biochemical changes. Anyone who knows how I got a go about working on particular health problems will know further that my preferred form is to study not just individuals, but study individuals within groups. And this, in these groups, I don't sit at the head of a class, pontificate, but engage in dialogue with group members so that together, and taking the advice of alternative health practitioners, we can build a mutually inspired protocol. Moreover, I work to recruit so that each study group will contain people from different backgrounds, believing the heterogeneity of such groups adds to the overall insight and impact. So I don't have all 32-year-old, 6'3" males. Everybody from all walks of life are included. For just as I decry a one-sided individualism, I am against the one-sidedness of single entrenched disciplines, especially when they act as exclusive clubs that restrict entrance to those who act and look the same. In the first pages of my my major works, you'll see that I mentioned that one of the shames of American medicine, including the Food Move Body Connection, I talk about it, is how it has worked to shut out all but the elite from its ranks. And Get Healthy Now is another example. I document how hard it is for a woman to enter the closed ranks of male surgeons. Although one woman I interviewed, for example, was qualified and hired by a hospital, her male co-surgeons did all they could to make her life a misery and drive her out of that medical specialty, which they desired to maintain as a male preserve. I also said earlier that this situation has seen some opening in recent years, although not as much as in a greater amount of higher medical personnel being drawn from non-elite groups, although this is a small part of the change. What is most significant in changing medicine and medical care is the way the average citizen is more forcibly taking part in their own health care. Now, here's a dark irony. One of the reasons for the great surge forward of people taking more responsibility for their physical well-being is AIDS. The limitations that have arisen in medicine and biological sciences is due to the infatuation of enclosed disciplines and elite control are being counterbalanced by the input from the grassroots. By grassroots, I mean patients, those and their advocates and alternative healthcare workers. This is a major breakthrough, and I dare say medicine will only progress to the degree it becomes a democratic enterprise. Thus far, it is not. That's why you don't see progress in medicine. You see advances in technology. You never see people getting better because of that. Hence, with all that we're spending, $1.5 trillion this year, do we have a cure for cancer, heart disease, arthritis, AIDS? No. But they say more. More what? What more do you want? 6 million people working in the field of medical care? The highest single budget for any enterprise in the world is in medicine? What more do you want to get your results? What if I can get results without more, but doing it differently? That would then mean they would have to entertain these ideas objectively, and that's a democratic process. There's nothing democratic in medicine. It kind of runs as a oligarchical state, but on the day-to-day level, it is filled with very limited perspectives, unfortunately. Let me present two examples of how the rules are changing in medicine because of this new input. One quite specific and limited to one hospital, one broader as it concerns networks of patients and physicians who have intervened to change the way drug trials are carried out as well as created community-based research. Schultz tells the moving story of Cliff Morrison, a gay clinical nurse specialist who in late 1983 set up and took charge of the AIDS Ward 5B at San Francisco General Hospital. He was able to take over the responsibility for running a ward, a task not usually delegated to a nurse, quote, because the most important hospital administrators all seem embarrassed by the ward, unquote. Morrison disliked the hierarchical nurse-doctor-patient model that dominated hospitals. He felt patients should have a louder voice in their own care, which only made sense. more Snowden because they usually knew more about the intricacies of their often experimental medications than doctors. Community groups had free rein at 5B. Morrison also rejected the idea of visiting hours as a concept designed for the convenience of the nurses, not the patients. And he instituted policies to permit visitors to stay overnight if they wished. Need I say that Morrison's ward became a model in its own right as a one place providing a compassionate and humane oasis for people with AIDS and their loved ones. Now, research into drugs is a place where the larger effects of the democratic tendencies that have developed in response to AIDS can be viewed. It would be no exaggeration to say that the face of science has changed by activists, patients, and alternative practitioners. As Dr. Epstein notes, according to the accepted wisdom, to correctly test new drugs, it is necessary to set up studies which put control groups in on placebos. Thus, while one group is taking the experimental medication, a second group is unknowingly swallowing sugar pills. Of course, when such experiments were done on AIDS patients, this course had extreme drawbacks. Quote, in blunt terms, in order to be successful, the study required that a sufficient number of patients die, unquote. This was because, quote, only by pointing to deaths in the placebo group could researchers establish that those receiving the active treatment did comparatively better, unquote. Well, no matter how scientifically necessary this seemed, it was hard to sell to subjects who would enter the experiment not knowing if they were getting any help at all from a new drug or, in fact, getting useless counterfeit pills. In consequence, in such programs, non-compliance, meaning refusing to follow the rules set down by experimenters, became rife. In one study, some patients were seeking to lessen their risk of getting the placebo by pooling their pills with other research subjects. In another, patients had learned to open up the capsules and taste the contents to distinguish the bitter-tasting AZT from the sweet-tasting sugar pill. What the episode of sharing pills makes explicit is that non-compliance is often accomplished by a group. Epstein argues brilliantly that whereas doctors running studies tend to view non-compliance as, quote, purely an individual effort, a truer understanding of the trend sees it as a community effort that represents more than simply a questioning of medical orthodoxy, but tends also to provide the setting for up of alternative clinics, the support of unique therapies, and the democratization of medical knowledge, unquote. Well, the mention of alternative clinics leads us easily to the second part of my topic, and that is the establishment of community-based research. Not only were people with AIDS dissatisfied with the way drug trials were conducted, they were upset by how few AIDS drugs were in the pipeline. Instead of waiting for the drugs testing, which would take a lengthy and cumbersome clinical trials, at academic centers, primary care physicians and people with AIDS decided to go about designing such trials themselves. In such trials, the testing of the drug would be combined with normal treatment and would avoid the bureaucracy and cost of trials carried out by the government. And the research that was done in this way in New York City was highly democratic. From the start, people with AIDS and HIV infection participated in decision-making about what trials were going to be done, and who should conduct them, and how they were going to be organized, and they set all this up. And that's how they got started. Now, that's where people can take back the power. This way of doing science proved its, quote, credibility and viability in the testing of certain drugs. In this case, it was on pneumonia, which was eventually approved by the FDA. And it was the first time in its history that the agency approved a drug based solely on the data from community-based research. This long aside has perhaps seemed to take us a distance away from the more objective question of whether HIV exists or not as a physical reality. But there is more to it than that. If, as I already suggested, the dissenting view of AIDS tends to support a different medical paradigm from the one valued by the orthodoxy, then part of this paradigm is that it looks at health, sickness, and healing processes from a broader perspective. Now, this viewpoint demands that when treating a question such as a controversy over the existence of a virus, one combines an examination of the scientific data with a grappling of the larger issues, such as the sociology of how scientists are affected by the corporate cultures of the disciplines. Let me just do a little summary on this. When I went to San Francisco not long ago to film on this new documentary that I've now completed my filming on this very topic, we're in editing on it now, I interviewed almost 200 people up and down Castro Street in the daytime, the evening, late at night, and I asked them, what are your views on HIV? Do you believe it exists? Does not exist? Do you believe it's the cause of AIDS by itself? Do you believe anything else helped causes it? Do you believe in the treatment? And 97% of the people said HIV is the sole cause of AIDS, nothing else, and that the treatment is AZT. And when I suggested what about immune-enhancing therapies, there was no belief whatsoever in those immune-enhancing therapies. None. I mean none. I saw people who were smoking and drinking who, yes, they had AIDS, and yes, they were taking their medicines, but their doctors didn't suggest they stop drinking or smoking. Just practice safe sex. That was it. So take your AZT or take your protease inhibitors. And yet these are the people who would want to have more drugs. And they were highly educated on the drugs. They knew everything about the drugs and which drug trials were going on and how to get cheaper drugs. And when I suggested, what do you think of the people who are challenging that the lifestyle may have contributed to AIDS? They either got angry at the assertion that they could have contributed to their own disease process, or that, as one of them said, and I believe from many of the others that he was really, could have been speaking for many of them, he said, well, if that were the case, then why haven't our leaders told us about it? And I said, well, it depends upon which publications you're reading. And I said, Charles Ortlieb of the New York Native spent years writing about a human herpes 6 and causing the symptoms of AIDS and how the drugs will create an iatrogenic episode that you can virtually not distinguish drug-induced AIDS, meaning from the treatment like AZT or DDI, and any other cause. And he could not get funding from the pharmaceutical industries that funds all the other publications that were willing to support it. And not only did these publications get funded, but many of them get, the editors and publishers get very large retainers as consultants, and they get to be on panels and get invited to the White House. And I said, do you believe that that could compromise someone's judgment of how objective they want to be? How far do they want to seek the truth? And then you'd get kind of a shrug of the shoulder. And I said, if it was shown tomorrow, if I could prove to you, if I could absolutely prove to you that the therapies you're doing are actually doing more harm than good, and that the lifestyles do make a difference, would you change? 91% of them said no. Those are 91% of the people that I interviewed. That tells me a lot, and I believe that we should pay attention to what people are saying. But there's a difference. A lot of times people say, well, people are out there getting AIDS because they hated themselves and it was a self-destructive lifestyle. Not true. I interviewed thousands upon thousands of people who were very happy with their lifestyle. In fact, the reason they got sick is because they didn't know when enough was enough. They would go back every night, every night, every night. More drugs, more drugs, more drugs, more of the fast-track life. We don't like to give credit to people for the mistakes they make. It hurts us to acknowledge that maybe they just weren't wise in the choice that they made, and now they're suffering because of it. So if we've accepted that your lifestyle had really nothing to do with it, it was a virus, and you passed the virus through unsafe sex, so that means that you could have had sex with 20 guys a night, providing that you use a condom. Otherwise, no problem. No one was talking about ammonitrate, and the scientific literature shows pop a popper under your nose to sustain an orgasm, and you've just knocked out your T cells. You've taken antibiotics, and you've just destroyed the bacterial flora in your body. So I see that where people are extremely diligent and making determinations that we want control over how this treatment is done and which drugs are done, the same paradox is that where they will seek that input, they will not seek any input that would challenge the basis of the nature of the virus or its cause or an alternative approach. In laboratory life, we saw the authors depicted the best scientists as consummate politicians as well as extraordinary researchers. If we went a little further in paging through Latour's Ovaire to study his work, The Pasteurization of France, we would see that there he applies his concept of what a scientist does both retroactively and frenetically. Just as Pasteur's is head and shoulders in scientific stature over the more run-of-the-mill scientist viewed in laboratory of life, so he towers over them in his degree of political hyperactivity. Pasteur's portrait might cause us to rethink many early assertions that the opening image of Gallo, flashbulbs popping as he spoke at Bethesda in a French restaurant about how he had the probable cause of AIDS, was something new to science. One of the most pervasive images of the scientists in the public's unconscious is that of the Dr. Frankenstein I mentioned earlier. Shorn of his criminal activities, such as grave robbing, he is a rather idealized figure in that he is working on his experiments out of a pure love for the game. He's not out to win points with colleagues who have laughed at him or to please grant givers. He is pouring his own fortune into his laboratory. Although he does hanker after fame, he is not looking for material success and is driven ultimately by a Prothean urge to penetrate the secrets of life. Such scientists have long ceased to exist, if they ever did. Latour, in his depiction of Pasteur, renders a 3D portrait of the contemporary practitioner. Pasteur is not a Renaissance man, but one could say that he is a tripatriate. As a professional, he has equal parts scientist, networker, and publicist. He did make groundbreaking discoveries, and once these were made, he began beating the drum to make his new practices acceptable to the public. While intensively cajoling, flattering, and threatening political supporters so as to form them into a broad supporting coalition, regardless of the fact that he was making genuine scientific breakthroughs, while I believe those who have claimed to pinpoint HIV as the cause of AIDS were not making such advances, both he and they follow the same public relations strategy. The initial insight is quickly set in stone, and all doubts are forbidden. Reservations or doubt, though they may be of value for a scientist, are anathema for advertising. I would like to go at Latour's idea in two steps. First, I'll question his basic position, which holds that good science can be created in the midst of a three-ring circus, as it were. Then, retracting my ground a little, I'll ask whether is it possible that Latour's portrait could apply to scientists in non-critical moments of research, but not at moments when paradigms are in flux. The first point, that Latour's type of opinion should be rejected altogether, is held by many dissenters. They argue that as mainstream scientists are involved, to one degree or another, in creating a heroic media image along with doing hard science, it is up to those of us who are more concerned with the search for truth than reputation to make clear that it is not the amount of fanfare a discovery manages to sustain, but its ability to be proven in light of the most stringent possible tests and to sustain itself against practical and interpretive criticisms that will prove it right. Dr. Stefan Lanka brings out what he sees as the heavy cost of being swayed by belief in a theory that has found great success and popularity in the media, in lieu of its proving its mettle in the laboratory. He is speaking of how the fight against AIDS has hinged on a belief in the existence of HIV, which belief stands on a very shaky collection of unstable premises. The AIDS myth, with its exploitation of the fear of an alleged deadly sex plague, has been blindly launched into the realm of seemingly scientifically based biological fact through the pseudo-rational HIV detection techniques, that is, the claim that have isolated HIV through new, previously unapproved methods. But the two terms, HIV and AIDS, according to the rules of construction, depend on each other. The clarification of the question whether HIV exists with the most secure method of identification available, and this would be only the isolation of complete HIV viruses, is a sine qua non for dismantling the mass delusional trance called AIDS. In other words, the edifice of a belief constructed around AIDS, which Dr. Lanka sees as containing as much disabling falsehood as Verity has as its core element, an abiding faith in the never yet substantiated retrovirus HIV position. In his opinion, if people saw how checkered and inconclusive is the history of scientists trying to isolate this will-o'-the-wisp, they would begin to revamp all their ideas about the disease. He says that HIV has never been identified as secure biological matter, is of the greatest importance, and must immediately be told to every stigmatized person. No HIV, no false diagnosis. No AIDS, no death sentence, no false treatment. No unnecessary suffering, no needlessly dying, but new chances for people who, for complex reasons, got seriously ill. Amongst them being labeled as AIDS cases and HIV positive at all, and then falling victim to medical short-sightedness based upon laboratory technical constructs, unquote. However, let me play devil's advocate a moment and accept that Latour's view has some validity. That is, I'm accepting that backbiting, currying favor, chasing the limelight, and other such unsavory traits may play a part in advancing science, particularly with the Latour-Wulgar thesis added, that all the individual scientist ploys to increase his or her credibility will only pan out if the science being advanced through them is good. I still maintain the situation is of limited application to a certain paradigm. A few words about the scientific paradigm as the concept was developed by Dr. Thomas Kahn in The Structures of Scientific Revolutions. His fundamental insight, which everyone cites, is that an older paradigm, such as the one currently used in medicine, or even an early one, the polemic idea that the sun revolves around the earth, becomes weak and has to be abandoned when too many anomalies begin to crop up, too many astronomical events clash with the worldview, and scientists begin to doubt its validity. A further point made by Kahn is that the one not so often cited, this is that the abandonment of an insufficient paradigm is not usually an orderly process whereby the old guard gracefully concedes they were wrong, apologizes to the world for wasting time, energy, resources, and hope, and jettisons out of everyone's view. No, the common chronology is that the group who has profited from the old paradigm holds on tenaciously for as long as possible, no matter how many anomalies are found, no matter how many people die, no matter how many bad protocols and bad procedures and bad drugs are given, no matter what. As long as they can have a quorum, they will maintain power. The new paradigm comes to power when older members of the discipline have died away. Quite simply, until all the existing physicians are dead, of old age or disease, a new paradigm in medicine will not take its place. After all, the older you get, seniority means that you have the power of control. Kahn poses the paradigm shift is based on both scientific and social grounds. While he identifies the social component as generational changes, other research links the support of alternative paradigms to different social groups. Everett McKendelson states, quote, the activities that scientists carry out are socially structured activities that are then related to social interest, unquote. These interests extend from the type we saw attributed to the retrovirologists, defense and aggrandizement of their scientific specialty, to broader direct social influences and interests such as religion, social class, or political position, unquote. When two paradigms are in opposition, scientists and others cling to either one depending upon these interests. In relation to recent scientific controversies in the United States, such as those over cancer treatment, Ronald Geer says, quote, the most likely source of the increasing controversy is a divergence in relevant values between those who were in fact making the decisions, such as the establishment scientists, and a sizable groups of the population, such as people with AIDS, unquote. Each backs one of the conflicting paradigms. I will temporarily hold back any discussion on the content of the paradigm I see emergent in the alternative health movement. But what I said in the previous program about the democratization forces that have become important in the AIDS controversy suggest where supporters of the new perspective lie, and also gives a clue to the limitation of Latour's ideas. His presentation to politicking, grandstanding scientists is one that fits within the bounds of an old boys network, such as that found among AIDS orthodoxy. It seems less applicable as a model of the relations within the more democratic, multicultural organizations we have witnessed in such phenomena as community-based treatment. There, science has advanced through more cooperative action. It may be wrong in its conclusion, but at least it's democratic and being wrong. You could point to many things in this station and other stations as doing the same thing. This takes us to our last point, returning us to the topic of HIV existence. In discussing evidence for and against HIV, I highlighted Duisberg's attempt to overturn Koch's postulates. I wanted to stress that the debate over AIDS has a marked tendency to move from argument over fine details to probing of the deepest fundamentals of science. When such a tendency surfaces, I propose this registers that an issue stands abridge the basic question of the validity of the dominant paradigm of science. Even beyond its presentation of colossal health risks and scientific puzzles, AIDS is an extremely sensitive topic, since many of the difficulties that it raises seem to suggest as part of their solution the overturning of the existing philosophy of biomedicine. Let me stop here for a moment. When we reach the end of this critique, I will make concrete points about where the AIDS controversy has exposed key weaknesses of the establishment paradigm. First, let's turn to the thorny topic of language. There is a manipulative definition of AIDS, or as we might have seen, the idols of the marketplace. It was not ill, said by Plato, that he is to be held as a god who knows how well to define and to abide, unquote. In the New Organon, Francis Bacon says, even if the existence of the retrovirus HIV was disproven, this would not lessen the number of people getting sick with AIDS, but it would redirect research in a new and hopefully more productive direction. AIDS exists, but not as a unique individual virus-mandated condition, but of all the original diseases people had. That is, it is possible that if we look closely at the statistics of those who are counted as having AIDS, we might find that they are not as awesome as we've been led to believe. We've already noted that AIDS tests are regularly rendered false positives. Moreover, we've seen that, especially in Africa, presumptive diagnoses are rife. The majority, probably 98% of all AIDS diagnosed in Africa, are not done by blood, but by presumption. And those presumptions could just as easily have been caused by hepatitis or malaria or tuberculosis or night blindness or malnutrition or dysentery. All the same symptoms, but we say it's AIDS. Well, how do we know it's AIDS? We don't. But the politics, the money, and the special interests said it's in our interest to carry it that way. And when a person dies of a disease that can be associated with AIDS, it is presumed to have the syndrome and classified as such without any administration of any test of HIV positivity or other factors that would have made the categorization reasonable. Now, I'm looking at our time, and I'm going to save this for our next program. I'm going to start in our next program to really dismantle everything that we've been taught about AIDS in Africa. And I'm also going to, now that I've gone through the basic philosophy of this, I'm going to challenge the drugs that have been used. I'm going to take each and every one of the popular drugs and show you why, A, the actual science does not support their use. I will also show you that just in the last 3 months, over 7 major drugs have been withdrawn from the market or reclassified because they were used on persons with AIDS and have proven A, not to work, and B, to have killed people. Little fanfare, you'd almost never know it, and yet they were all brought out and all promoted with great fanfare and made enormous amounts of money for the manufacturers and the proponents. I don't see a single apology. I don't see anyone coming forward saying, hey, you know something? I advocated these people take this and today they're dead. And I should have paid attention. They didn't. Well, I'm going to pay attention to the drug trials and to the fraud in some of these trials. Plus AIDS in Africa, And I have two more programs which will be wrapping up this section of our show. I'm Gary Knoll, and this brings up to the end of another program. If you'd like a tape of this show, this is tape number 11 in the series on AIDS, A Second Opinion. You can call 888-317-2346, program number 2671. Have a good day.